Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. The Eco Leadership Institute is about to launch our new Diploma in Leadership Coaching. This comes in two parts. We have depth approaches to leadership coaching and systems approaches to leadership coaching. These are two certificates, and if you take them both, you receive our diploma. The depth approaches will include some of our Lacanian psychoanalysis. So if you've enjoyed this podcast, please get in touch with us, and we look forward to hearing from you. Welcome to Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, our very special guest is Leslie Goldenberg. Leslie is a coach and an award-winning ceramic artist. Over the past years, her work has increasingly come to address the unconscious at work, particularly in organizational life. Leslie earned her MA from UCLA and is currently a student at the Lacanian School of Psychoanalysis of San Francisco. She holds a PCC credential from the ICF and has a Master Coach certification from the Hudson Institute of Coaching. And Leslie was trained on her own Eco Leadership Institute coaching approaches. Leslie, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
Thanks, Simon. Good to be here with you.
Good. So today we thought we'd start off with thinking about a man called Jacques Lacan and his influence on both of our works, and how we apply Lacanian thinking to coaching. So we'll start there and we'll see where this goes. What got you interested in Lacan's work initially, Leslie?
Well, so many things in my life start with a book, Simon. And what first got me interested in Lacan was a book. It was Annie Rogers' book, The Unsayable, which is a gripping read. And it was my first introduction to Lacan. And after I read it, I thought a couple of things. First, boy, I have some more of my own work to do. Yeah. And I got started doing some of my own work. And I had also the thought, I need to learn more about this Jacques Lacan guy, and got busy doing that as well. And that has just set a whole chain of things in motion. And here I am.
Yeah. Yeah. So for people who don't know, I guess we should say something about Lacan. Where to begin? Jacques Lacan is no longer living. He was a French psychoanalyst who really upturned psychoanalysis. He challenged the IPA in the way psychoanalysis was being taught and being delivered. He's a controversial figure, but also a very a live figure, not only in psychoanalysis in clinical settings, but also in academia. I think it's important to say that his work kind of transcends the clinical setting. Anything you want to add, Leslie?
Well, I think what's been happening in the last maybe 10 or 12 years is that his clinical interest in the UK and the US has been growing. It's always been there in France and in Latin America.
Yeah.
But up until recently, Lacan was much more present in departments of comparative literature or, you know, other film, other humanities kinds of areas. And his clinical message has become much more present more recently in our parts of the world, Simon. And I think that's partly because it's so relevant to the world that we're living in.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's what got me interested. I was studying at the Tavistock Clinic, and they really focus on object relations and Melanie Klein and beyond this kind of British School of Psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. And I always felt a lack there. And I was looking kind of outside. I was doing my dissertation, and I thought, there's something missing here. There's something missing here. And I started reading broader than what they were teaching me. And I came across Lacan's work, and it really kind of fitted into that. I was actually in a clinical piece of work, working with a group, and it really kind of helped me in the work. It wasn't like some nice idea. It was actually something which really structurally helped me in what I was doing, and it kind of really, really made a difference to my work. And since then, it kind of triggered my interest.
How did it help you? What was the idea that made the difference?
It helped me. The idea at the time which made a difference was the idea of the name of the father. That the Kleinian model, it seemed to, for me, that what had happened in British psychoanalysis was they'd moved from kind of Freudian kind of work, which is very much about the paternal figure and the father. They'd gone to a very maternal idea. It was all about the mother and the breast, about containment. And I was trying to do this work under the supervision, and I was trying to offer this maternal containment and a safe space to work. And something wasn't working. And I realized that what they needed was another input. And the name of the father came up, that I was against authority kind of being used, you know, like an authoritarian stance. But Lacan gave me this way in to say that the name of the father is not the actual father. It's symbolic. And it gave me kind of a way that we actually needed to bring some structure into this work. We had to kind of bring more structural containment as opposed to maternal containment. And it really helped me kind of think about that and what I was doing. And it changed kind of the way I worked. I got a distinction in the dissertation, and they ended up teaching my paper called Where's Daddy, on kind of how to bring the father metaphor into our work. So that was my introduction.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing about Lacan that is so fun is the wordplay. Mm. And so in French, you know, the name of the father is le nom du père, which is also, in the French ear, the know of the father.
Yes.
Yeah. The limit setting of the father. And maybe that's what is so helpful in some of this sort of symbolic use in a group. You know, where is the know? Where is the limit?
That's right. That's right. And then I got interested in Slavoj Žižek's work, and Žižek, I think, introduced Lacan to many of us in Europe, and in particular and beyond, who really kind of drew on Lacan's work to kind of think about social and cultural kind of issues and political issues and make those connections. And what really captured me was the idea of lack and desire, words which we didn't use much in British psychoanalysis. It is very much a pathologizing kind of way of thinking. You know, you kind of looked at the wounded self, you were looking at the defenses. And to start thinking about desire, start thinking about jouissance and enjoyment was kind of a revelation to me, and how that informed kind of human behavior individually and collectively.
Yeah, well, desire is one of those things that has really continued to be, it's a mystery.
Yeah.
And also a really important idea, I mean, really a foundational idea for Lacan, I think, is desire and how it works, and how it works as part of a system. You know, even the word desire, if you look it up etymologically, means from the stars. It's not something that's coming from within us. It's something that's out there. And there's a kind of circulation of desire. In fact, Lacan has this whole graph of desire that shows algebraically how desire moves through in relationship to an other, a big other and a small other. And there's a kind of, I don't know, there's a kind of pressure, a kind of constancy in desire. If you're lacking any desire, then like your life force is gone. But when you're feeling that, you know, urgency of desire, you also feel the sense of something's missing. It's a very kind of paradoxical phenomenon.
As is much of Lacan's work.
Yeah.
What do you make of the difficulty in reading Lacan? I mean, so many people, like, they ask me, it's very interesting what you're doing, Simon. What can I read? And I say, well, you can try and read Lacan, but in some ways, I mean, Lacan didn't write much, did he? He spoke a lot.
Yeah. Well, his whole theory is about speech, that we are speaking beings. And most of his teaching was given in these lectures that he did over 23 years. And you can read them. His son-in-law took on his life's work of getting these lectures transcribed and published. And he's, you know, close to the end of his life and almost done, I think. And so you can read Lacan. There's also a couple of things that he wrote, the Écrit and the Autre Écrit, but you know, a very little amount that he actually wrote with the intention for it to be a published work. So reading it requires remembering that you're reading the transcript of a performance. You're not reading an essay that was done to be read. And it is hard. And it was done in French, these performances. So there's lots of wordplay and there's lots of stuff that you might not get if you're reading it in English, which basically is what I have done. I have a little French, but not good enough to do all that. So it's hard, and it's much easier to do with another or with a study group or with a seminar where there's some help to pick apart what's being said. And I think it's also really helpful to think of it more like poetry, you know, where there's more than one interpretation. And that's what Lacan said too, is, you know, he was trying to be a little bit more evocative than directive, and making your own sense of it is part of the point. And if you want to have someone who makes good sense of it and is more readily accessible, read Bruce Fink.
Yeah. No, Bruce's work is good. I mean, I learned that as well, that you, I would go to Lacanian talks in Dublin and in London, and I'd go and hear Zizek, and I'd go and hear other people. And I realized in the end that I should stop trying to understand this like through the discourse of the university, as Lacan said. You know, it's not, this is not a kind of knowledge you learn in this sort of empirical way. You have to kind of let it wash around you. And then when it washes around you, you go away with something very rich, and you're not always sure exactly what that is, but that's kind of, you have to kind of learn to listen through the discourse of the analyst, I think, in a very different way. And it's kind of, and in doing that, you're changing yourself anyway.
Well, I think this gets to the essence of what psychoanalysis is, as far as I see it, which is it's an experience.
Yeah.
And you have to be in the experience, which is what I hear in your description.
Yeah, and I mean, Lacan talks a lot about transmission. This experience is transmitted. It's not something taught. And I think that's very important. Do you want to say a bit, Leslie, about how you're actually using your connection to Lacan and coaching, how it shows up in your work at the moment?
Yeah. So the main way that I would say it shows up in my work as a coach is in my listening. Mm-hmm. And my listening has changed so much since I started studying Lacan. And I think it's one of those things that's so obvious, Simon, what we're working with when we're coaching people is their words. Yeah. And our own. And yes, we might go visit somebody's workplace and we might have org charts and spreadsheets and other things that are beyond their speech. But the main thing that we have is their speech.
Yeah.
And really listening carefully to what it is that people say and the things that repeat in what they say and the kinds of metaphors that they use and the verbal litter. That's what I call the throwaway words, the unintentional utterances that people produce, the ums, the whatevers, the right, the you know me. There's all kinds of versions of this. Mine is you know.
Yeah.
That there's an unconscious piece of information in that. That is a production of the unconscious too, along with other things that Freud and Lacan would have pointed to. And listening for those and asking about them, lifting them up and seeing what kind of information they might hold is the main way that I am using the Lacanian sort of principles in the work that I do. I think the other main thing is that I use dream work in coaching.
Okay.
And ask people, not every person, but I ask people about their dreams. And sometimes that can be very, very fruitful.
Yeah. And your clients, how are they responding to your picking up on language and unusual dreams, basically trying to make these connections with the unconscious? What's your experience of your clients' responses?
So the feedback I get from clients is about my listening. I mean, yeah. Wow, you know, you ask really great questions because you're listening to what I'm saying, like, and I take that as a huge compliment. It's, you know, it's you're not supposed to be so gratified, but I find that very gratifying.
You're allowed to be, Leslie. Be gratified. Enjoy it.
Yeah, I'll take some enjoyment from that. And I do really enjoy the listening too. You know, being able to really hear what people are saying is fascinating. And I suppose I could analyze myself on this and say, well, maybe that's because, you know, I haven't received enough lift in my own listening. And there's something about my own desire in circulation here.
Yeah. And you're in analysis yourself as a part of your practice?
I have been. I'm getting very close to the end of my analysis, which is one of the Lacanian ideas that maybe is related to coaching as well, is that in the Lacanian world, an analysis is supposed to come to an end. It doesn't go on forever. And of course, that's how most coaching engagements are too.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I'm interested in a relationship. I mean, most people, or maybe that's a generalization, but you know, people think of a psychoanalysis as like 5 times a week on the couch, interminable, goes on and on and on. And yet, the 50-minute hour, and Lacanian work is quite different from that, isn't it? There's the short session. There's the pass, the end of analysis. There's quite a different kind of structure to it.
Yeah, there is, and there's many different structures to it, because I think the other thing about a Lacanian analysis is that it's singular, and that the frame, there's an essence of the frame, but that it's constantly being renegotiated and reconstructed for each analysand.
Yeah.
And each session, even, you know, the sessions might have a variable length. It's not just a short session. I think it's really important to say it's a variable length session.
Yes. Yes. And for those listening, this is when you're lying on the couch or sitting with your analyst and just at a very important point, and you're just about to tell them everything you want to tell them, they say "le cut," and they thank you and ask you to leave. and they do this at a chosen point in time, a significant point in time, so that you are left with something to work with.
Well, that's the whole idea, is that most of the work happens between sessions.
Yeah.
And sending you off to do some more work is the point of that. And we were talking about editing just before we got onto the recording. And I think that's a kind of editing, you know, that there's.
Yeah. Yeah. And it punctuates. It really kind of like this idea of punctuating, it kind of like you're left, like it's a bit of a shock quite often, and you're left, but you're left with something very kind of punctuated to reflect on. It's powerful.
So as a coach, my variation on that is not to say, let's stop here, you know, see you next week. But it would be more to say something like, what are you taking away? The typical kind of coaching, what stands out? All right, go have some more, go do some more thinking about that.
Yeah. 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 Me likewise. I don't kind of, we don't have a contract with a client in the same way as you do in psychoanalysis, where you kind of agree to le cut, but you can kind of punctuate your session and highlight something for people to go away and think about. I'm also like, we're bringing some Lacanian thinking into our coaching programs. You did our coaching program on depth, and we talked quite a bit about lack, about symptoms. And we're bringing that into the session because people coaches have been increasingly interested. I'm quite surprised the levels of interest in psychoanalysis and the levels of interest in Lacan's work. There's a real growing interest and people want to kind of really engage. I think there's something there which is lacking elsewhere.
Simon, I have been able to see the incoming requests, referrals that come into the Lacan school for people seeking to consult with the psychoanalyst. And it's astonishing to me how much interest there is.
Yeah.
And it does seem to be growing. I take that to be a sign of the times. And I also take it to be that people have tried a lot of other things. We often say in the Lacanian world that it's the last resort. People try all kinds of other treatments before they come to a Lacanian analyst. In fact, I'm starting to think of myself maybe as the coach of last resort.
Yes, yeah.
And that there's a kind of exhaustion that people have with all of these other methods that have tried to, that they've tried. And this is something different. And it is not intended to be a therapy. It's not, there's not a fix in this. The promise in it is that there will be a kind of deep listening and maybe an opportunity to get less mired in your own unconscious patterns once you start to hear and see them. And then it's up to you to do something with it. There's not a homework assignment that goes with it.
No, that's right. And this is another thing really interested me and gripped me in this, the idea of you're not there to cure your symptom. You're not there to kind of do reparation work. You're there to put your symptom to work for yourself and for society. And, and I love that because like putting your symptom to work for yourself, that can kind of increase your narcissism. You can get caught up in just kind of what do I need to do for me? But putting your symptom to work for yourself and for society really spoke to me. And it's kind of what we teach on our coaching course around, you know, identifying your symptom, which is like some kind of essence, which is close to yours, Rishant's, how you enjoy things, and you circle around and around it, and it's part of your life. And the idea is not that you kind of repair that or make that good or get rid of that, but you put it to work. And I thought that's very interesting.
Yeah, you honor it.
Yeah.
And you apply it in some kind of create. It's, I think, back to the artistry that's part of my work too. You apply it in some kind of a sublimated way. You turn it into a work of art, into a creative production. And that may not be a visual work of art. It may be entrepreneurial. It may be something that you do as a scholar, as a coach. I think there's lots of ways that you can put your symptom to work.
Yeah. You could care for children. You could, there's many ways. There's all sorts of different, very individualistic ways, but it's to identify this symptom which you circle around can be really transforming for people. You know, they see these patterns, they see these repetitions, and they kind of realize that, you know, using one way it can be dysfunctional, using another way it can bring life to them.
Well, this is another maybe connection to one of your other questions about how to apply Lacanian ideas in a coaching circumstance when we're getting started with people, and even as we're moving along with them, asking about body symptoms.
Yes. Yeah.
It can be really fruitful. You know, asking someone at the beginning, do you have any chronic body symptoms that would be good to know about? And that is often a pathway into starting the unconscious work.
Yeah, that Lacan does a lot of work about the unconscious, not just being kind of like a depth psychological kind of idea, but kind of being in the body and being relational, isn't it? And then again, in my coaching work, the body is becoming more and more present in my work because of this.
I'll give you an example of someone who asked me about body symptoms, and I had a really hard time thinking of what that was. It was the very beginning. And I finally said, you know, I've been biting my nails my whole life. Maybe that's the only chronic body symptom I could think of. And it turned out that unlocked so much.
Yeah.
Of course it did.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I recently went to a Lacanian conference in Dublin, and I was like you say, the interest is incredible because I was expecting probably like 80 to 100 people maximum, you know, to come to this conference, and there were 650 people from mostly from Europe, but from a few turned up from Australia, and you know, in South America and Latin America, it's kind of thriving and flourishing.
650 people, yeah, at a Lacanian conference.
650 analysts in one room together.
650 alienated people in one big room.
Yeah, it was something else. It was a powerful experience.
Well, I haven't been in a room that big full of Lacanians, but I've been in plenty of gatherings. And it tends to be, in my experience, these gatherings, very activating. Mm. There's a whole lot of unconscious productions that are happening, being, you know, piled up over the few days of the event. And I leave these events full of ideas and just kind of vibrating with a kind of activation.
Yeah. Something really strange happened to me there, actually. I was sat in this conference room, and it was 2 days, and those case studies being, clinical studies being shared, and it was very interesting. And like you say, very, very stimulating. But I felt the need to leave, and I was like, I should stay. Like, and listen, this next session is going to be really interesting. But I felt the need to leave, and I left for a Quaker meeting, which was across the road, Dublin Quaker meeting. And I'd never been, and I'd wanted to go. And the session I was in, the Kenyans were talking about a clinical case study of working with psychosis. And psychosis is quite a theme because traditionally psychoanalysis works with neurosis, not psychosis, but the Lacanian work with psychosis as well. And this kind of really, really left me thinking. And I walked across the road and I went into the Quaker meeting and I sat in silence and I let this wash around myself. And I found myself standing up and ministering. In Quaker meetings, you can minister, so anybody can stand up and speak. And I found myself quaking and on my feet. And I just read something about the Quakers in a book beside me, which was talking about the Quakers being a peculiar people. And I thought, I need to share this message. I'm not quite sure why or what it is. But the unconscious is speaking through me, or the spirit is speaking through me, and I need to share this. So I stood up and I said, I've just read this piece and remembering that the Quakers are peculiar people, and I've just left another peculiar people, 650 Lacanians in a room. You know, they're also a peculiar people. And I talked about the need for being nonconformist. The Quakers were nonconformist, that we need this in society, people who are thinking differently and thinking in different ways. And I sat down, and at the end of the meeting, a young woman turned around and said to me, can I talk to you? And she talked to me and she shared that she'd been in a mental hospital that morning and she'd had a psychotic breakdown. And we spent like half an hour kind of talking about that experience. She had to go back and I shared a number where I could offer some support. But it was very interesting kind of unconscious process, which took me there to meet this young woman who had a psychotic breakdown and offer some support when we were kind of talking theoretically about this. It was a very powerful kind of moment.
You know, that kind of uncanny experience is part of what I appreciate about psychoanalysis too, that it honors the truth of that. Those things do happen and there's a meaning in that.
Yeah, there is a meaning, and it's I mean, what I'm finding, I did some psychoanalysis with Jacques Alain Miller, the translator you talked about before of Lacan's work in Paris, and then I stopped, and I've just started Lacanian analysis again in Dublin, and just how you become more sensitized and more aware of your own unconscious and the unconscious of others, just how that awakens you to different kind of potential is phenomenal, actually.
It's very hard to transmit this to people who haven't experienced it. And I think this is back to our comments earlier. The truth of the unconscious is something that you have to encounter in an experience of your own dreams, or in an encounter with an analyst who lifts up some of the verbal content, or it could be in the mistakes, you know, the parapraxies and the errors that keep occurring in your life and make you realize that there's something else going on under the surface that you can't see. You can barely know it, but maybe you can know enough about it that you're a little bit less mired in it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is hard to transmit, but they talk about the effects, don't they? And it is kind of the effects on your body and the effects on how you live your life, and which is important.
The connection to the Quakers, I think, is something I want to come back to, Simon, because in addition to studying Lacan over these last number of years, I've also gotten quite attached to Quaker studies and Buddhism as well. Mm-hmm. And I see these things all having lots of interconnections, and maybe that's the truth of lots of contemplative wisdom traditions, is there are connections between them. But the Quaker practices of listening, I think, are very Lacanian in a way. I've been to a number of Quaker retreats now where we have these circles of trust, you know, where somebody can come with a trouble of some kind, and they share a little bit of background about what it is, and everyone else in the circle listens. And the guidance is that you can ask open and honest questions. And they have to be questions that are sort of non-directive, non-judgmental, really intended to help the person with the troubles hear themselves deeper. That's the intention. And the questions are asked. The person who's receiving them can respond or not, can say, can you write that down? I'll think about it later. And it goes on for 90 minutes or a couple of hours. And when it's done, it's completely done. It's double confidentiality. If anyone's taken any notes, they give it to the person who was the focus person, and never is it spoken of again. The person who's been the focus person can raise it, but no one else can speak of it. And it's like a really profound kind of intense analysis without all the framing and the transference and everything else. But I think that the Quakers are really onto something that may be healing for lots of others to know about.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And I don't think these things are separate at all. I think these traditions pass over into each other. And I found it very amusing when I first went to the Tavistock Clinic and I sat in their groups, their Beyond groups. I thought, this is Quaker meeting with a different language. You know, we're sat in silence, waiting for someone to be moved to speak, you know, and whether it's the unconscious speaking or whether it's the spirit speaking, there's a different language, but it is very, very familiar. And then, of course, I learned that Beyond's great colleague, whose name escapes me at the moment, was a Quaker, and they introduced this way of being into this work. So I think there is this transmission from different other traditions. And the other thing in the Quaker meeting I experienced during that session was when I quaked, and I wasn't sure whether I should stand up, and I was like, should I or shouldn't I? And I remembered that to minister is not about kind of ministering for yourself or for your own ego or for your own need. It might be important for someone else or for the collective. So this idea that this unconscious is not just kind of owned by me and you, and we have our own little worlds, that it's relational and it's on behalf of the whole. And I that kind of spoke to me as well.
Yeah, there's something else about the Quakers that's very interesting to me as a citizen of the United States. You learn when you're a kid that part of the founding of this country was the Quakers and others coming here to have religious freedom because they were being persecuted in their own country. But you don't really learn about what it was that they were doing that was so blasphemous that, you know, they had to leave. And it's only in recent years that I've discovered what was happening was the Quakers believed in their own access to the divine, that they didn't need a priest. They didn't need a church. They didn't need all of the authority figures in order to have a spiritual experience or a religious gathering. And that was so intolerable that they had to be ejected. And I just think that's fascinating. And you, with your own description about your relationship to authority, maybe that's part of why both of us are interested in the Quakers.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I entered a Quaker meeting because they gave free tea and biscuits when I had a young infant. I was unemployed, and I started to read their posters on the wall, and I kind of got drawn in. And you know, it was interesting. They never proselytized. They never tried to kind of convert you into anything. It was like, you know, just come, you know, just come and be. And it was, and then I started reading this kind of radical stories about the 1650s in the UK and their nonconformity and their kind of these radical ideas about letting women speak, you know, completely radical, you know, that the women could speak as well as men, that God spoke to us all, you know, and everyone was kind of had this access to the spirit, and it didn't have to come through kind of the professional preachers. Yeah. So yeah, it was very, very engaging, and it spoke to me. What about your relationship to ceramics and art and the transfer of the unconscious into that world? Do you want to say something about that? I'd be very interested to hear how those things connect or don't connect.
Yeah, I'd love to say something about that. So ceramics specifically, I think, is a wonderful metaphor because we're working with clay. Clay is earth. Clay is dirt. Clay is what's left over after all the composting has happened. And there's some soil that's able to be manipulated. Clay has memory. If you see vessels that have been made that have cracks in them, that's often because of in the forming process, something happened and there was a crack and it got rubbed over, and in the firing, it reemerged. Clay has memory and it goes back. And then the other thing about clay is that it's so long lasting. I had a ceramics teacher very early in my ceramics journey who said, when you make something in clay and you fire it, you are entering the archaeological record. because the things that we find from thousands and thousands of years ago that have lasted are often fired clay, mm-hmm. pot shards and figurines. So there's something about clay and its kind of transmission of time and its durability that's very appealing too. And then my own work in clay, I've done everything over the course of my life because really I've had my hands in clay since I was about 12 years old. But the last number of years has been making masks mm-hmm. and very expressive, not portraits, but something much more kind of an unconscious production. And I work with a method called raku, which is a very rapid firing of the glaze process that uses the fire. So there's a lot of unpredictability. And all of that is part of what I think is so interesting. The mask as a metaphor, the mask as an object, the mask and the fire and what they make together. And I do use masks in my work as a coach too, not clay, because the technical requirements of doing that are too much, but on a piece of paper. Yeah, have people draw or color in or add words, what's showing, what's not, because the mask has two sides. And there's just so much that you can use in this whole the mask as metaphors, also, of course, all over Freud and all over Lacan and lots of other psychoanalysts too.
Yeah, no, it really interests me, the mask piece. As you know, I wrote my first master's dissertation on puppets, masks, and psychotherapy. And I used to do mask work with young people. And when I started to do it, I thought they're going to, you know, these are angry young people quite often. And I thought they're not going to do this. But it was incredible how a mask can transform and enable and open up. And the way we inhabit, the phrase I like was about inhabiting masks. You don't kind of wear a mask, you inhabit a mask. And it does something to your body and allows you to speak differently.
Yeah, and if you're able to work with different masks, you can inhabit more than one. You know, if you put on a happy mask and then you put on a sad mask, something is going to change.
Yeah. When I suffered a great loss, one of the things I used to do was walk along the River Thames. There's something about seeing big skies and water. I don't know what it was. But then I discovered fragments of pottery. And I collected it. And every day I collect some fragments. Mm. And they're with me. These fragments, for some reason, are very important. And I'm still, I think one day I might do something with these fragments. But it's a very important part of my processing or grieving. But it's interesting, like you say, there's this over time, this period of time of different lives have been lived through these kind of bits of pottery. I'm not sure exactly what, but yeah, it's an important part of my process.
You found the fragments walking along the Thames. They were on the shore.
Yeah. Thinking about what the past lives of the Fire of London and the people's lives. The people using these old potteries now for hundreds of years past. Beautiful bits of glass and polished glass and the water and bits of pots and stuff. Yeah.
Well, it's a kind of transmission too. Something that got handed on to you.
Yeah. It is. We're coming to an end, Leslie. There's a couple of questions I like to ask my guests. They're big questions, but I'm going to ask them. Have you any thoughts, free associations on what it means to live a good life and to create a good society from your work and your life?
You know, Simon, it feels to me like an invitation to grandiosity to even attempt an answer to these questions. These are questions that everyone needs to grapple with for themselves. So I guess I could thank you for the invitation to attempt to do that. And here's maybe what I would say as a lacking attempt, which is all it could be. The question makes me think of Margaret Wheatley. I've studied a lot with Meg Wheatley too. And her idea about being an island of sanity appeals to me as a way of living a good life and creating a good or maybe a good enough society. And it's the notion that we can focus on our immediate circle, on the people that we have access to and whose lives we touch, and to bring out warmth and kindness and creativity, and that's really all we can do, and that is good to do. The effect of that might might ripple out. And even if not, it's still good to focus on the people whose lives we touch with warmth and kindness and creativity. And so to live in this fashion, you know, it could be a model for others, but it's really up to them to make the choice.
Really is. Wise words, Leslie. Thank you so much. I've had a really rich conversation. Enjoyed it so much. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you, Simon.